So they would go in first, and then at the specified moment or time, the rest of the crew would walk into the ops room. And in walking into the ops room, that would be the first time, or I should say the briefing room, the two normally were the same, the first time that the captain knew what the target was. He would have no idea. He would know what his bomb load was, because he would have been out to his airplane. He may have even done an air tester in the morning and gone out to talk with the ground crew because of there being some minor unserviceability he wanted to make sure was taken care of, and he'd go out and talk to the what we would now call the crew chief, and the sergeant in charge of his ground crew for his airplane, to make sure that it was all straightened away. And in so doing, he would know what the bombs were that were being, because his aircraft would be bombed up, or they would be in the process of bombing up his airplane. So he would have at least some idea of how far they were going to go, or how far away the target was, by the number of bombs that were being put up. The shorter the raid, the bigger the bomb load. The longer the trip, the thing, the lower the bomb load, because it meant more gas, and it was the old business of a straight saw. You had the all-up weight of the airplane was controlled, but normally it was set at a given figure, and it varied only slightly with temperatures, which had an effect on the lift conditions of the airplane, which meant that your all-up weight did fluctuate a wee bit. But for the sake of argument, let's say it was set. Well, once your all-up weight was set...
You call it all-up.
All-up weight. That means the takeoff weight of the airplane. In other words, what do the engines have to lift in the terms of pounds?
Right.
And there is a maximum under given temperature and the humidity conditions.
Right.
Now, there is a safety factor built into that, so that if you lose an engine, you have a chance of surviving. But in those days, it was so thin that it was... That hence that business about getting the altitude, so if you lost it, then you have control. The saw-off was petrol against bombs. Mm-hmm. So that on a long trip, you had more petrol, so you had less bombs. Mm-hmm. On a short trip, you had less petrol, so you had more bombs. Mm-hmm. So the only thing that the pilot would get, the captain of the airplane, would be an indication of how far he was going by the bomb load that was being put on his airplane.
Yeah.
But that's all. And then to walk in, and the crews were all allocated tables, and of course his navigator would have already been in there with his charts spread all over the place. And at the end of the room, up on the dais, there would be the map of Germany, or the map of Europe, and on that would be the route done in red string, or to show the actual route to the target, and of course the target itself.
Mm-hmm.
And those were the two things as far as the captain was concerned, that he wanted to know what is the target, of course, and what is the route.
Yeah.
And then the briefing would start, and we'd go through the weather, the bomb load, the defenses, the tactics for the particular raid, such as altitude, the approach to the target, a discussion of the target itself, what is the aiming point, what are the specific points that would help to identify the aiming point that could be seen visually on that particular night, the position of the moon, if there was a moon, and how it would reflect off rivers or lakes in the target area. All those sort of things would be gone into in some detail to help the crews do their job.
Mm-hmm.
And the briefings would normally take the better part of an hour to get through all of that. And then, of course, the station commander would say his words of wisdom, and then there would be any questions.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I'm sorry, intelligence got into this as well, of course, an intelligence briefing. What was the target? Although Bomber Command has been accused of the blanket bombing, always there was certainly in the early days, there always was an industrial target. That was what they were really going to try and get. The fact that it turned into blanket bombing was just was a result of the techniques that were used, not a matter of initial policy of blanket bombing.
Mm-hmm.
It was an attempt to do pinpoint bombing, but the technology just wasn't there to permit it. So it became blanket bombing rather than pinpoint bombing.
Was there any
preferred bombing height?
Well, the question of height was important because of the ACAC defenses. In the earlier days, the Germans in the early days had not really perfected the radar prediction for their 88 millimeter guns, mm-hmm. which in turn became to be very, very, ultimately became extremely effective. The other thing that bothered people was, of course, there was an awful lot of light ACAC, the 20 millimeter type of mm-hmm. ACAC. But that normally wouldn't get up above about 9,000 feet. And they would just hose it up into the air. Yeah. In the earlier days of the war, there were some of the crews who believed in bombing from a low altitude. In other words, they wouldn't hesitate to go into on a target at 4,000 or 5,000 feet. But in so doing, if they were picked up by searchlights, then their chances of being shot down by light ACAC were very great. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't very long before everyone said, "Okay, what are the light ACAC defenses?" In the briefing. Asking the intelligence, and we had artillery people associated with the group too, who were the experts in anti-aircraft and who would provide answers to the squadron. It was a simple matter of picking up a phone. If a question came up and you wanted that man's experience or an answer, you just pick up a phone and go right through the group, and he was waiting for that kind of a call, and he'd provide the answer immediately on the phone. So the altitude was number one, get above the light ACAC. Why stick your neck out and take a chance on getting hit by that? Then the next thing was the weather. How high was the weather going to go? What fronts were you going to encounter? And if so, what was the top of the weather? Because you always wanted to stay above the cloud if you could. Because of the freezing level and the risk of icing. We were still in those days learning about aircraft icing, the various kinds of icing that you could encounter, like clear ice. Clear ice is when you run into a cumulonimbus cloud and you've got super cool water, and all of a sudden you've got clear ice half an inch thick all over your airplane, and all of a sudden you've lost your lift. You're in trouble. Or it could be a sort of a hoarfrost, where you would just simply pick up a bit of ice, icing on your leading edge. And if it didn't get to be too thick, it wasn't too much of a problem. But if it got a little, they would reach the point when it would start to interfere with the airflow over the wing, and the air then would begin to tumble. So all of a sudden, you begin to lose your airspeed, you begin to lift, and you begin to lose altitude. Well, icing was always something you watched for very carefully, and if you ran into icing, you had to change your altitude. You either had to go up, or you had to go down. You just couldn't stay where you were. You had to move or get out of the cloud. So altitude part was a question of what altitude is the best one from a weather point of view. So you had ACAC, weather, and then finally you did have winds. Even in those days we didn't understand the jet stream. We had no idea that there was such a thing as a jet stream. All we did know was that all of a sudden, for some unknown reason, you could run into terrible winds. And if you did, you had to change your altitude. You had to get away from those bad winds. Mm. And now, of course, we understand what it was. Mm. Well, you'd run into the jet wind, into the jet stream. In the wintertime, the jet stream comes down. Mm. And the normal flight altitude was about 18,000 feet. So we say from 15 up to, say, 20,000 feet. Sterlings were lower because the Sterlings just couldn't get up there. Sterlings normally went in about 12,000 feet. And that was it. But the Halifaxes and the Lancasters would get up around, let's say, 16 to 18,000 feet. And in the wintertime, the jet stream will drop down that low. And we did run into the jet stream problems. And again, I can relate some of those experiences later, where they caused almost chaos. But altitude was partly survival. And there was the other feeling, too, that if you were up high enough, when the night fighters, it would take a night fighter just that much longer to get up to you night fighters came out. So the higher that you were, there were always somebody below you, and the night fighter probably would pick off somebody who was below you rather than come up to your altitude. It was a matter of, really, it was survival, and in part, and so there it was.
this would interfere, nevertheless, with your accuracy.
Yes, it would, but only to a degree. The bomb sites we had in the early days were not accurate bomb sites. I can't remember the mark, the initial, the early ones. I think there's something like the Mark 9 bomb site or something like that. They were not accurate ones. And bombing accuracy was really... good bombing only occurred if you were bombing below 10,000 feet. Once you got above 10,000 feet, the accuracy was less, but it did not deteriorate all that badly, sort of in that 18,000-foot level. But no one was going to go in below 10,000 feet, because that's where all, if you were in a heavy debris, that's when you ran into light ACAC, and you were just asking for trouble. So bombing accuracy there were many things that affected the bombing accuracy. The bomb site was one, altitude being the factor in that bomb site. But there were others, such as a straight identification of the aiming point. Again, in those days, either bombing through cloud, well, no way. It was blind bombing, and more often than not, the bombs missed a target completely. Not only did they miss the aiming point, they'd miss the bloody city if the winds were bad.
Yeah.
So that you would miss the whole kit and caboodle. If it was clear, the other terrible thing that Bomber Command was constantly fighting was what was called the creep back. It seemed that when a raid started, the raid might start right on the aiming point. And for some unknown reason, crews would begin to drop their bombs a little short. They'd drop their bombs on the fire that was there, and of course the fire would begin to creep back. Mm-hmm. Until the last crews coming in were probably bombing outside the city by this time. And that creep back became a terrible problem, because it was affecting the accuracy it was an accuracy problem that was affecting the efficiency of the raids. And when I talked about the base commanders, this became the thing that my base commander would hammer in his briefing about, you must not bomb short. You've got to make sure you come up on the aiming point before you drop your bomb. If you do, the chances are 10 to 1 you're going to drop them in fields outside the city or in a suburb where it's not going to do any bloody good at all. So that was a psychological thing. It wasn't anything to do with bomb sight. It wasn't anything to do with weather. It was a natural, instinctive fear on the part of the crew to go in on right in on the target if he could get away with bombing short. And in those early days, we didn't have cameras on board, as we did later, where when the bombs were dropped, a photo flash was dropped at the same time. And then the captain had to fly straight and level, so that when the flash went off, it was timed, of course, and his camera, the lens would open, and he would bring back a photograph of the target. And again, it was so arranged, the timing of the whole thing, of the camera, that the center of his photograph, if he had been flying straight and level, the center of his photograph is where his bomb would fall. So for the first time, only when we got cameras, and it was the bombing short that caused cameras to be introduced, that there was a way of checking up on a crew as to how good were they.
Yeah.
And it became a very serious matter. Many crews were front and center because they had not brought back a photograph. And, Jesus, you had to have a bloody good story and why you didn't bring back a photograph. Because there was always that chance that you had dumped your bomb somewhere and hadn't even gone near the bloody target. So it was straight fear.
Exactly. Yeah.
So another thing, of course, the one thing that people would use, and it happened, of course, quite often, you were in the middle, you were being predicted, and you were in the middle of a box of flak. Mm-hmm. And you couldn't fly straight and level. If you did, your chances of being shot down were very, very good indeed. Mm. So you may have been taking evasive action at the time that your photo flash went off. But even then, normally, providing you weren't on your side, the camera probably would pick up some kind of a picture, and it would indicate whether you were flying straight and level or whether you had been taking evasive action. But if you're over cloud, as far as nothing, there was nothing you could do. There was no photograph, nothing. It was just a picture of cloud if you get some photographs to pick it up. So bombing accuracy was a terrible problem, and the earlier raids in Bomber Command were unsuccessful, with the odd exception, because of weather, navigation problems, and the question of getting in on a target that was heavily defended. If the target wasn't heavily defended, okay, no problem. The troops would go through.
But a good target, presumably, would be.
Oh, sure, the Ruhr would be. It was the Ruhr. Hell, you ran into Ruhr defenses about 50 miles outside the Ruhr. So you are running the gambit, so to speak, all the way in and all the way out.
Yeah.
And you can understand fear. Again, I'll relate stories on what happens to fear and what it can do to crews. I had a couple of experiences of that with some of my crew members. But it can happen. I mean, it's terrible. I'm sure you've seen the same. I'm sure the infantry have seen the same sort of thing, of where a man, literally, just loses complete control.
They become battle happy.
They either freeze or they lose control. Well, what else can I say about the preparation? I suppose
one little. Well, did you have a question, Chris?
Yeah. I was just wondering about on the ground crews. You mentioned that you have a ground crew for a specific plane.
Yeah.
Were you assigned? Each plane was assigned a
ground crew.
Flight crew and a ground crew.
That's right.
So you didn't have a big pool.
No. In those days,
if something went wrong, you knew who to go see.
That's
about
right.
It.
Oh yes. And not only that. If it was something serious, the NCO who was in charge of your ground crew for your airplane, he would be the one, if he couldn't fix it with his own crew, his own immediate crew, who were looking after the minor unserviceabilities, it was his responsibility to get that airplane into the base maintenance organization, where they had greater depth of maintenance capability, and stay with that airplane until the base or the central maintenance, or the heavy maintenance, or what really is called the second and third line echelon type of maintenance, was completed. But you didn't worry. It was his baby to get that bloody airplane serviceable, whether he did it himself or whether he took it into the base maintenance organization, with his own crew helping to get that damn thing serviceable. But his primary responsibility was to look after the minor unserviceabilities. Most of the unserviceabilities were minor unserviceabilities, which he'd have an electrician, he'd have a wireless man, he'd have an aero engine man and an airframe man, and that basically was the ground crew. And between them, they would keep that airplane going until something serious happened. When that happened, then it was taken into the barn and looked after by the base people. There were inspections that had to be carried out. What we call a minor inspection could be done by that servicing crew. A major inspection, if the airplane should last that long, had to be done in the central maintenance organization, because it meant stripping things. It meant to pass an engine change. It could be all sorts of things, which were beyond what could be done out on the dispersal point. And I should make the point that the airfield was laid out in such a way that the bombers were scattered all around the perimeter of the airfield on hard stands. Literally, all that would be out there would be an engine stand, at least a stand that somebody could climb up to get to an engine or a wing or a nailer on or something like that. But that's it. And they just worked out of toolboxes. So it was toolbox maintenance with your ground crew. Anything required beyond that, they had to go into a hangar. The hangars were in where the main base area was. The idea of dispersal, of course, was to prevent intruders coming in and literally machine gunning the field and catching a whole string of airplanes in a row.
Yes, they did in Pearl Harbor. I'd like to keep us for the next couple of minutes on the ground before you take off, right?
Yeah.
And there's some smaller points, perhaps. One of the things you mentioned was that when the squadron or group or what have you went on an operation, you would know that a certain number were going to be shot down, or at least the likelihood was considerable.
Right.
What about the instructions you had, etc., respecting escape.
Escape and evasion?
Yeah.
Yes, escape and evasion was, in the early days, was, we were, I think I probably, we had one briefing as to what to do. Mm-hmm. But every, one of the things you picked up when you went into the briefing room was a small escape and evasion package. And that package had oilskin maps in it of the area where you were going to, and currency. Currency of either German currency or French currency.
One like this.
That's the idea. Same idea. Yes, like that. That's right. And you just stuck it inside your inside pocket of your battle dress.
Mm.
And that's all. And that basically, that was about it. There were other gimmicks which they brought in later, such as buttons that would have compasses in them.
Mm-hmm.
There were several little gimmicks like that, having a compass sewn into the lining of your battle dress. But the real the center of escape and evasion was a package, just like a first aid package.
Yeah.
That's all. And it would have just enough in it that to help you survive. There were no rations or anything like that. It was literally to help you with money and maps, the two most important things.
Some weaponry?
Nothing. No, no. As a matter of fact, weapons, when the crews didn't carry any weapons for a very good reason. When you did land, if you bailed out of an airplane and you landed, and you were unarmed, no reason to shoot you. If you were armed, they could shoot you and say that you were armed and you were threatening them or whatever, or you had pulled the weapon, whatever.
Yeah.
And it was policy that and it was broadcast to Germany that all air crew were unarmed, and therefore there was no excuse for shooting them. Even though they were still shot on many occasions, but they were never shot because they were carrying a weapon.
Mm-hmm.
And the briefings on escape and evasion were a simple matter of, try and get to, Spain, Holland, and no direction on how to get in touch with the underground or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You were told that if you were lucky, you might be picked up by the underground before you were picked up by the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
And that's all. There was no way that they would, even if they did know, they would never brief crews on the underground for fear that in interrogation this would come up.
Mm-hmm.
And of course the underground would then immediately be picked up. Underground were having a tough enough time remaining underground as it was, without any air crew spilling the beans on them and causing them to be picked up by the Gestapo or the Germans in general. So escape and evasion was very much of a hit and miss proposition. Like a lot of other things in Bomber Command, an attitude, and it became an attitude. It ain't going to happen to you.
Yeah.
And it was as simple as that. Every time you cranked up your airplane to taxi out, you just simply had to say to yourself, it ain't going to happen to me. Because if you dwelled on the odds against you or what might happen, you would become a mental wreck in no time at all.
I agree. Yeah.
So it was very much, I've used that phrase again a little later on, when I reached, I did, I almost convinced myself that it just wasn't going to happen to me.
Yeah.
And I think it was that conviction that allowed me to go on. Because, every raid I was scared stiff. I was not one of those people who maintained that they didn't know the meaning of the word fear. I think there were one or two. I think Willie Tate, who was another great RAF man, I think Willie Tate was a man who had... He really didn't. He didn't understand the meaning of the word fear. It just had no feeling at all. Hard as nails. I'm not too sure about Cheshire. I would have said earlier on that Cheshire didn't have any nerves, but As I found out later on and got to know him better, I think he bloody well did.
Yeah.
And he was probably just as frightened as anyone else.
Yeah.
But that the only way you could overcome that fear was by sheer concentration. You had a job in hand, and there was enough to keep you busy. As a matter of fact, once the raid got going, you got off and you got airborne, and you were on your way, and something happened. You were happier because you were so occupied taking care of that, whatever it was,
yeah,
that you didn't have time to dwell on what might happen,
yeah,
to you.
Yeah.
And every raid, you literally reached the point where you took every raid as it came up.
Yeah, one at a time. As you say, it's an attitude that you have to accept.
Right.
If you go into battle thinking you're going to get a bullet between the eyes, one becomes, as you say, rather twitchy.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. Yeah,
self-fulfilling prophecy also.
Yeah.
Well, that's where I a phrase I've used many, many times in talking about this, that I became an optimistic fatalist. that contradiction, because it was. You had to be a fatalist,
yeah,
and you have to be because what's going to happen is going to happen.
Yeah.
If your number comes up, that's it. On the other hand, you were optimistic as hell that it wasn't going to happen to you.
One other thing, Rosa, am I right, and I think I am, in believing that there was no parachute training for you fellows?
No.
You would have parachute, but nobody...
No, no.
Would
no, you never... You, no, 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 you never... I guess, again, it was part of that philosophy that it would never happen to you. And you were... it was a question... In bombers, we had what we called a chest pack. You didn't wear, you didn't have a seat pack. You wore a chest pack. And the reason for that is that several of the crew members had to move around. Well, you didn't take a gunner. A gunner couldn't operate in a turret, which was cramped to begin with a bloody great big parachute either on his chest or on his ass.
Mm-hmm.
The parachute was hung in a spot, and there were containers for parachutes all through the airplane. And if in an emergency, what you did is you took the parachute, and there were two clips on the harness that you wore, and there were two hooks on the back of the parachute pack itself, and you slapped it on your chest. And it had the D-ring on the right-hand side, if you put it on properly. Many people, they've had picked up people who put the parachute on upside down, and the D-ring was on the left-hand side rather than the right-hand side.
Oh,
yeah. And they actually hit the ground, and with the side of the parachute torn with their fingers, where they were trying to get to the D-ring. And in the panic, hadn't realized that they thought the D-ring had been pulled and the parachute hadn't gone. Hadn't realized that they'd put the parachute on upside down so that the D-ring was on the left-hand side, and all they had to do was use their left hand and pull the D-ring. And so there were, that happened. Not very often did that happen. But it did happen. So that in an emergency, the gunners, for example, would have to get out of their turrets and then grab their parachute, which would be in its holder, and slap it on, and then get to an escape hatch.
It could be done that quickly?
Oh, yes, it could be. Oh, yes.
You
it was just two...
Sort of.
No, negative. No, it was a very simple operation. There were two... what was the name for those hooks? Can't remember the technical term. There's a very common word for them. And they were just two bloody great big hooks with a safety catch on them, and two rings on the underside of the parachute pack. And it was a very simple matter just to bang, and it was on. And literally that simple. In fact, it was more difficult to get them off. If you ever put it on, it was a hell of a job to get those goddamn things released to get the pressure, because they were very heavy hooks. They had to be, because
okay,
they would take the strain of the initial inertia and so forth. And also the seats were hard enough. A seat pack in a bomber, when you on certain raids, hell, I suppose the longest raid I did was probably 8.5 to 9 hours. Sitting on a parachute pack for 8.5 9 hours. Jesus, that's awfully hard on the backside.
Mm.
And it was even bad enough with, they weren't the kind of cushions that one would have today, such as synthetic cushions and rubber that we have today. They were just an ordinary hard, hard cushion covered with leather. And, Jesus, even that was terrible after 8 or 9 hours of sitting in fairly cramped conditions. And you couldn't get out. There was nowhere to go if you did get out. The escape hatch for the people in the front of the airplane was normally underneath the navigator's position or the bomb aimer's position. There was a hatch there. And if you had to get out of the airplane, the crew at the front would go out through that bottom hatch. Pilots had an escape hatch above their head that they could use, but to go out that way, you took a chance of clobbering the tail or the either the rudder or the elevators, and you took a chance of killing yourself that way. And so people didn't like to go up the top. They had to go out through the bottom.
Yeah.
So you had to be able to move around the airplane as a normal routine, but you had to have something that you could put on quickly if things went wrong. So that's why there was no parachute training.
If you're just going to have to go once, you probably got as much chance of surviving once with no training as if you spent all that time.
Oh, absolutely. I have no idea what the failure rate on the parachutes was. I have no idea. I don't even know if there were any, much less what percentage there might be. But we, again, I suppose, developed the philosophy that had to. Only a crazy man would jump from a serviceable airplane and use the doctrine. You only jumped when you absolutely had to.
Wasn't there a case, or was it just a film I saw, of a crew abandoning an aircraft and the damn thing landing in England?
I don't know. I haven't heard of a case like that. There were cases where captain bailed a crew out on fire. They had been hit and on fire. And then, all of a sudden, the fire burning itself out while he was waiting for the crew to get out and before he himself got out of the airplane. And then suddenly realizing that the fire had burned out. And then going back and disengaging the automatic pilot. We had an automatic pilot in those days, but it was a very pretty crude one, but it worked. Going back to his automatic, going back to the seat, and then flying the airplane home by himself. Yes, yes. Oh, there were several instances of that. We had one in 35 Squadron, which was with the squadron commander. And again, I'll come to that one later. But where the squadron commander took the crew along because he decided he would go on a trip. He didn't. Squadron commanders never had a crew on their own. They always made up a crew with people either who had not finished a tour, were getting close to the end of a tour, their crew had finished, they hadn't. They were left to do a few trips. Then the navigation leader or the wireless leader or the bomb aimer leader who did do trips, he might grab them and make up a crew. But the squadron commander never had a crew as such. He always made up a scratch crew. And in this case, the skipper of the crew, of that particular crew, was sick. He'd had a touch of the flu or something like that. And so the squadron commander decided that he would take that crew on this particular raid. And it was a raid to Italy, and by God, he bailed them. They were hit. And they had a load of incendiaries, and the whole pile of incendiaries hung up. And God, they were hit, and they caught fire in the wing. And of course, the whole bloody can of incendiaries on fire, I'm sorry, not in the wing, in the belly. The whole incendiary is on fire in the belly. I mean, it's not very long before that airplane is going to go up in smoke. And they had tried to get to the, open up to get to through the inspection panels, but they couldn't get to the incendiaries, and it was a roaring, raging, bloody inferno. So Robbie was his name, Robertson. So he bailed the crew out, and God, he was just getting ready to go out himself when, boy, he took another look, and Jesus, it either burned itself and dropped free. Anyway, the fire had gone out. So he climbed back into the seat, and he had to get the navigator's log, the navigation log, because he had to fly that buddy airplane back to England. And he got the log, and he flew the navigator's log, which had been prepared in the Oxford before the flight. He had with no idea what the winds were, but literally flew on a forecast log, and instead of landing back in at base, he landed way down somewhere in southwest England. And he was a very unpopular man when he came back to the base the next day with the captain, who had been ill and had heard that his crew had been bailed out. I mean, they'd been shot down, well, that would have been. That's it. That's the name of the game.
Yeah.
But to have bailed the crew out and then brought the airplane back himself, I thought that character was a young flight lieutenant. I thought he was going to shoot the squadron commander. I really did. It was a dreadful scene when they first met. But it was kind of the kind of tensions that were that you ran into.
But surely he did the right thing.
Oh, he did the right thing. Of course he did. But as far as the captain was concerned, he'd lost all of his crew.
Yeah.
And that meant he had to put a new crew together, he had to train a new crew. And Robbie had come... Robbie was not a popular man, anyway, to begin with. He was a bit of a bore, a very overbearing man. And I think it was a combination of all of these things. A dreadful scene. And Robbie, I must give Robbie full marks, he let this boy get it off his chest. And he really did. He himself was pretty uptight, of course, as any squadron commander was. But he didn't... he let it get off his chest, and he apologized. But the boy, once he'd worked it out of his system, he saw that he had done the only thing that he could do, and the chances were 10-1 that his crew were all alive.
Yeah.
As it turned out, they were. We got word back that they were POWs; they'd been picked up. But it was the sort of thing that could happen, and bailing out. It happened. There were many people who, when the aircraft blew up, and somehow or other they grabbed their parachute as it was going by and managed to get on and still came down. No idea of how the hell they got hold of their parachute when the airplane blew up. Quite incredible cases like that. There are several, but phenomenal. Just no explanation for how the hell it happened. But you get that sort of thing under wartime conditions.
Did you ever have any crew members who parachuted out over enemy territory and returned to the squadron that you know of?
Not my own personal crew, but and one story I do want to relate when we get on to the operations here is one, and I'm going to take the time to tell it, because I think it is one of the most incredible stories of the war in terms of surviving. And that lad survived the war, too. And matter of fact, I've already mentioned his name, Don McIntyre. He was the other Canadian who was at 35 Squadron. Mm-hmm. We arrived about the same time. We arrived together as pilot officers. And... an incredible story. And it's not too far down the line in the book when I come to that one.
Well, we'll start you on your first operational trip on our next...
on the next interview.
Lovely. Lovely. Yeah.